From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Once upon a time, there was an animation studio called UPA. UPA was the David to Goliath Walt Disney Studios. They did not last long, but in their brief history, UPA revolutionized cartoons. Their story has been expertly chronicled in a new book called When Magoo Flew, The Rise and Fall of Animation Studio UPA. The author, Adam Abraham, is a film historian and joins us this week to talk about UPA. Adam Abraham, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
Well, during Walt Disney's most creative period between 1927 and 1940, he sought to make animation as close to real life as possible, to hide the hand of the artist and to imbue his characters with enough life to sustain a feature film, and to elicit tears from his audience, tears for a drawing. And then UPA came around a few years later. How did UPA's approach to animation differ?
It had to do with what animation was supposed to be. The question is an animated film going to somehow emulate real life or real life activity? You know, if you saw deer scampering in a forest, what would they look like? What if you were at this angle? What if you were above? What if you were below? There is a certain realism in the approach to a Walt Disney film such as Bambi. The other view is that an animated film is not a movie at all, but animated film is rather a form of graphic art, more like plastic art, more like contemporary art, more like the types of magazine and illustration work being done in the first half of the 20th century. So some of the UPA artists, and many of them were actually trained at the Walt Disney Studio, sought a different approach for animation that would be closer to a plastic or graphic art, that did not try to make it seem like cinema, like it was doing what Gary Cooper could do or what a live deer in a forest would do, but that it would do something that Picasso or Mondrian would be doing, or The New Yorker, which was also a big influence. So it was kind of just a shift in terms of what you want an animated film to be. So that was, I think, the impetus.
And the guys, you say that they had been trained at Disney, and in your book you talk quite a bit about the strike that in 1941 at the Disney studio and how that kind of opened the door to UPA.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of misunderstanding that the strike began at the Disney studio because of aesthetic reasons, that artists were unhappy with Walt Disney's filmmaking processes and wanted to do something more radical or innovative. That's not completely true. I mean, obviously, there could be a grumbler in any group. The strike was really based on economic reasons and job security and the types of problems that would occur in any workplace. Animation is no different in that respect. If there's management and labor, you know, there will always be tensions. But the result of the economic strike at the Disney studio was the freeing up of a large body of talents who did have this excellent training at the Disney studio in the 30s, who were then kind of thrown out into the waiting world where they could take their talents elsewhere. And that meant, in some cases, other studios such as Screen Gems, which is not particularly well known today, or in some cases to the war effort, because the U.S. was entering World War II right around the same time that the Disney strike was finally concluded. And then, thirdly, to the UPA studio, which began in its earliest form in 1943. So, to some extent, it was the beneficiary of the Disney strike in that you had this amazing mass of talented, well-trained people who brought their skills elsewhere and were seeking and now had the opportunity to do some other kind of filmmaking besides the Walt Disney kind of filmmaking.
Well, you know, Disney claimed that communists were behind the strike at his studio. Was there a truth to that?
You know, it's another world. That time has passed. I mean, in the 1930s, among artists, among people on the left, there was definitely an interest in communism and a flirting with that. And should we remember that this was pre-Cold War, so the Soviet Union was not exactly the enemy. In fact, they were our ally during World War II. Mm-hmm. So there was definitely an interest among artists in Los Angeles and other places to, you know, explore communism, to read Karl Marx, to have meetings. It seemed to be a pretty benign type of setup. And I talk about this a little bit in the book. You know, one gentleman described, you know, a meeting once a week in Westwood where they would try to read, Karl Marx's Das Kapital, and that was about as far as they got. Another person mentioned the coffee and donuts type of meeting. So it didn't seem like it was exactly a world plot to take over the United States of America and redirect it towards a more Stalinist regime. So while there
But were they
was,
trying to take over Mickey Mouse and turn Mickey Mouse into a kind
No,
of...
no. I mean, basically, essentially it was a scapegoat. That's the short answer. You know, when you're angry, you look for someone to blame. Walt Disney, you know, was a highly paternalistic boss. He loved what he did, but he wanted to do it his way, and anyone who stood in the way of that was going to be seen to him as a nemesis, whether that person was a banker or whether that person was a union head. So, they, you know, there was, and this began in 1941, you know, in press reports, Disney and his lieutenant Gunther Lessing did blame communists and communist agitation. It doesn't really hold because you don't have to be a communist to want to get a living wage or to want to not have to work on weekends and holidays without additional pay or to not want to be fired without cause. So there's certain things that were on the union side, which are pretty reasonable, that doesn't seem like an attempt to take over. At the same time, I hope that I do show some sympathy to Walt Disney and his view, because he was right in that if, you know, if the union came in, there could be a balance of power shift, and it's possible that he would not be able to make the same films again. And to some extent, that's exactly what happened, because, I mean, Bambi was well underway by the time of 1941. The film came out 1 year later. But in the post-war years, he didn't exactly make the same kind of films again, so something did change. So you could say it was the war, you could say it was economic shift, you could say it was changes in taste, but to some extent, they never quite went back to being the studio that made Snow White and Pinocchio and Fantasia. There's something about the later films, as wonderful as they are, that's a little more staid, a little less exploratory. So he was kind of right, you know. But the fact is, it was not an attempt by communists to take over his studio. That is a false suggestion. There were people who were members of the Communist Party, but as I suggested, it seemed to be a relatively benign organization at the time.
So these ex-Disney animators ended up forming their own studio, UPA, and made these cartoons that were pretty strange.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard today to go back and look at some of these films. I mean, the wonderful thing that happened this year, by complete coincidence, Turner Classic Movies has released a DVD box set of many of the classic UPA films of the late 40s, 1950s.
And you had this a part in the assembling the box? Or?
Yeah, well, they invited me to contribute to the liner notes. I wound up working on that. And Jerry Beck and Leonard Maltin did some of the audio commentaries. So it's just a wonderful box set. And as I wrote this book for the last 3 years, I never actually thought that was going to happen. And I actually almost wrote a sentence in the book saying, like, and these films are not available and never will be. But I somehow resisted writing that because you just never know. And lo and behold, in the same exact month, March of this year, the book was released by my publisher and this box set was released. So the fact is, these somewhat strange cartoons are now quite readily available to anybody who wants to watch them. And I don't think I suggested every single one is a masterpiece, but there's really interesting work being done there. Yeah. And it's not what you might expect if you grew up, as I did, on Bugs Bunny and Tom and Jerry. UPA is trying to do something else.
They're really fascinating. I mean, you know, the pacing of them is really unusual. I think you pointed out in your book, they're not exactly funny. I mean, they're very amusing.
Yeah, it's kind of like you smile with your intellect. I mean, some people blamed UPA for not being funny, and, you know, I don't know if the cartoon has a responsibility to be funny. That's what they did traditionally, but I think animation as a medium can do almost anything. And it's nice to see UPA making an attempt to give the audience a different kind of experience, not the same experience. You know, Tom and Jerry cartoons are excellent, but each one, to some extent, gives you the same experience. That's part of the pleasure. If you see that logo on screen, you know the physical pain will follow. At least for the characters on screen, hopefully not for the audience.
Not for the audience.
But if a UPA logo comes on, you don't actually know what's about to happen. It could be funny. It could be odd. It could be a little bit sluggish. It could be a little bit ugly to look at. It could be based on literary classic. It could be based on something you've never heard of. So there was that openness to the strange, to the unusual, to the surprising. I think it's one of the most wonderful things about UPA. Some people blame the studio for not making Bugs Bunny or making films that were always just pitch perfect in their hilarity. But I think that animation can do other things. I'm glad that UPA tried.
We're talking with Adam Abraham, and he's just written this great book called When Magoo Flew, The Rise and Fall of Animation Studio UPA. And although UPA did have Mr. Magoo, and I guess in some ways Mr. Magoo ended up hammering a stake into the studio, but
I thought you were going to say Mr. Magoo wound up having UPA.
I guess he did. And there was also Gerald McBoing Boing. But I think when they started, they wanted to avoid animals, they wanted to avoid recurring characters, and they wanted to avoid violence. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the recurring character is the one they probably couldn't really get away with. They definitely did not want to do talking animals, you know, the fable kind of narrative, and they did not want to do the cartoon violence. You know, some of them had worked at Warner Brothers, where violence was kind of the métier. But they were savvy enough about the film business to know that an animated starring character is a staple and is to some extent a necessity. So when the third UPA cartoon for Columbia Pictures, The Ragtime Bear, was developed, they did quite intentionally develop the idea of creating Mr. Magoo as their kind of starring vehicle. The important thing was that he was not an animal. He was a man, and an old, curmudgeonly, nearsighted man at that. So I think there was a sense in that that would kind of give them an insurance policy so that they could continue to do their experimental things. I mean, the model here was indeed Walt Disney. During the 1930s, he made two kinds of cartoons. He made Mickey Mouse cartoons, and he made Silly Symphonies. The Silly Symphonies were one-off cartoons without a continuing series character, so that could include something like Flowers and Trees or something very popular like Three Little Pigs. But each of those was meant to be a singular experience. So UPA obviously had this in mind, and if they could continue to make a Mr. Magoo series, then that would kind of give them the leeway to make the occasional oddball cartoons, which originally were called Jolly Frolics. So that was pretty much the model for the first 3-4 years of UPA under the Columbia contract once it was up and running. So Mr. Magoo gave them license to do what they really wanted to do. I can't even say that in the book, but I think you can make that argument. I mean, they never said it. I never saw that in a quote. But to some extent, that's what they're doing, unconsciously or consciously.
And there's a kind of a Mad Men feeling in your book. You know, you can sort of see them, like, you know, in their office. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I guess Mad Men went on the air when I was starting to come up with this book, so I don't know if it has a connection or not, but there's something about the 50s, early 60s when, you know, it's just the button-down world and the skinny ties, and, I mean, if you look at some shots of the UPA office in Burbank, the interiors just have the perfect 50s modular furniture and, you know, open space design and all those kinds of elements. So, you know, obviously everyone's smoking at all times. And martinis were often consumed lunch. So it's real, you know. I mean, I think that show is very entertaining, but it's also capturing something that did happen. That's how people lived and behaved and smoked and drank during that period. So yeah, it definitely. And the fact is, UPA began to work almost from the start with Madison Avenue Advertising Agency. So there's definitely a connection there. They were producing animated cartoons for television. I mean, commercials. So it definitely has a connection to that world. So I don't exploit that, but it's there if you want to find it.
What are some of the commercials that UPA did that we might remember?
I mean, I don't know what people remember. I mean, the best one that I've seen was a Jell-O spot designed by Saul Steinberg, who was a wonderful artist in his own right, called Busy Day. There were a lot. They did stuff for CBS, they did stuff for Good and Plenty. They did any number of campaigns that I just, most of these things are pretty obscure and hard to find. Animated Hollywood films of the 50s are somewhat obscure, then 30-second and 60-second spots are even more obscure because it's not even clear who owns them or where the materials are. They're not really considered quote-unquote art and have not been particularly well preserved. So obviously individual collectors have those things. But probably even more interesting than TV commercials would be certain industrial films that UPA continued to make into the 1950s, including a very strange one for CBS Radio. In the 50s, as you can imagine, television was on the rise, and CBS Radio felt obliged to defend itself and produced UPA to make this animated cartoon that kind of makes radio look cool, even though radio doesn't look like anything. So, I mean, that's an example of some of the interesting kind of industrial, you know, hired work that they were doing. Essentially, it's a commercial, but 7 or 8 minutes instead of 30 seconds. So, I mean, that was kind of the origin of UPA, because the company began under the somewhat awkward name Industrial Film and Poster Service. So it was, designed to make films for industry, and to some extent the military. So those were the roots of the studio. But even once the studio began to have success in the entertainment realm with Hollywood Cartoons and Mr. Magoo, they continued to make these industrial films. Apparently they're pretty well paid. So they did them for the American Heart Association, for all sorts of different entities that would hire UPA, pay the costs, and make a sort of film to order. And yet, you know, despite the fact that they were for industry, a lot of them were aesthetically really, really cool.
Well, we should talk a little bit. We're talking with Adam Abraham, and he's the author of a book called When Magoo Flew, The Rise and Fall of Animation Studio UPA. We should talk a little bit about the look of the cartoons. I mean, they were, how would you describe them? I mean, they're flat, and they're really obviously drawn, and the, you know, the, like when McBoing Boing moves from a blue background to a pink background, he changes color from blue to pink.
Yeah, I mean, in that particular film, Gerald McBoing Boing, which to some extent was the breakthrough film for UPA as a producer of entertainment cartoons, there was definitely the idea that this will look like a drawing on screen. That, you know, you earlier mentioned that Walt Disney wanted to hide the hand of the artist. UPA was really doing quite the opposite. They were making it extremely clear that this was something that was made. It was crafted. It is an aesthetic experience that's been designed by somebody. So you wind up paying attention to the line, to the drawing, to the shapes, to the colors. I mean, colors, you know, were also used quite naturalistically before the rise of UPA, you know, to a large extent. In something like the film you just mentioned, Gerald McBoing Boing, there's a sense in which the color shifts are really expressionistic. They don't necessarily deal with naturalistic lighting as it would appear to the human eye, but rather they're expressing something, an experience that the character's feeling. And the character is changing color from scene to scene, from transition to transition, to express his journey in color, you know, what's happening to him in an emotional way. So it's really a wonderful piece and exemplary of what UPA was trying to do and often succeeded at doing.
Well, it's interesting because the idea, I think, that Disney had, that in order to get the audience to shed a tear, the characters had to appear very real. But you know, there are some of those, particularly the one, and I can't remember what it's called. I think it's Family Circus or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little girl, and she's neglected by her daddy because there's a little baby boy in the house. And it's a very emotional cartoon, and I think it's very poignant, even though it's very unrealistic.
I think the amazing thing is that you can actually get to poignancy in 6 or 7 minutes. There's poignancy in Warner Brothers cartoons as well. I mean, I think there's the ability to do that if that's what the director wants to do. And I think that UPA was open to that emotional experience, and I think that they showed that there's not only one way to get it. I mean, you know, Gerald McBoing Boing is an emotional experience as well. You know, even though it is clearly made by a human hand, it still can move you in a way. There's a scene in which Gerald's father is shaving, and Gerald, who cannot speak, is somehow trying to communicate with his father, and he's forbidden from the room, and it's a really crushing moment where this boy can't communicate with his father and is basically kicked out of the room. So I think that you could do a whole paper on UPA and stories about parents and children. There's definitely something to do there. It also has to do with the studio being rebellious. You could make an argument that UPA is kind of the rebellious child to Walt Disney's stern father. There's definitely a case made there. So it's intriguing that so many of the cartoons wind up playing out a parental child story. The other reality is the age of the artists. You know, a lot of these people by the 40s and 50s were of the age where they were reproducing and having children of their own. So they were thinking about that story. And, you know, that's obviously related to a larger baby boom in that the late 40s and early 50s relates to a time when the United States had a population boom. So to some extent, they're making stories that they felt that architecturally are the story of UPA versus Disney, but most importantly were kind of what people in the audience were feeling, you know. I mean, Gerald McBoing Boing is a young person. He's essentially a baby boomer. You know, if he's 5 or 6 in 1950, then...
Right.
You know,
yeah,
he's that generation today. He'd be thinking about Social Security.
he's the classic baby boomer. Isn't he the same boy who wants his Mapo? He looks a lot like the boy who wants his Mapo that John Hubley.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a Hubley cartoon from a little bit later. Yeah, I mean, certain design elements will recur. I mean, I guess if you're an artist, you have a certain way of drawing things. you know, there's, I mean, they, at Hubley Studio, he was trying to make a film based on Finian's Rainbow, the 1947 Broadway musical that never actually came to being, but his sketches for the character Finian look a lot like Magoo, and I wouldn't even say it's plagiarism. I just think, like, if he's going to draw a short, squat, curmudgeonly man, he might look a little bit like Magoo. So I think there's a way in which, you know, people just have, you know, a knack or a way of seeing something.
It's also interesting that Magoo doesn't look like the Mr. Magoo in The Ragtime Bear.
Yeah, I mean, the character devolved. I mean, if you look at Mickey Mouse in 1928 or the early proto-Bugs Bunny, these characters change. They get a little bit better. I mean, you could argue whether the earlier Magoo, in terms of design at least, is better or worse than the later one. But the first one, the one that appears in Ragtime Bear, is a bit rougher, more jowly, a little more unpleasant, both in his personality and in terms of the drawing. But it's interesting, in that very first film, it seems to me, and I do make this case in the book, that even the artists weren't quite sure what Magoo looks like. And if you look at The Ragtime Bear carefully, it does seem that Magoo's image changes a bit within the film from scene to scene. I'm pretty sure there were two or three different animators doing him. They might have each drawn him a little bit differently.
They didn't have a model sheet or whatever, because he changes size a little bit in it.
I mean, that could happen in a film that is new. You know, they're not quite certain yet. But apparently it also seemed to be related to John Hubley's style. He was the director of the film, and one of the animators in that film, Willie Pyle, described Hubley as very loose. He would sort of do a quick sketch, hand it to the artist, and say, here, that's Magoo. And then another day or two later, another artist would walk into Hubley's studio and get a slightly different drawing. That was Magoo for Tuesday. So I think that result appears in that film. By the 50s, there was a woman named Sterling Sturtevant who really kind of shaped the ultimate Magoo that we would perhaps recognize. It's a little more streamlined, a little cuter, usually nattily dressed, as one of the artists said. So that became the standard model in roughly the mid-50s.
And I had said earlier that Magoo, hammered a stake into UPA, because eventually that's all they did was make Magoo and make him for TV, right?
Well, anyone can become a victim of one's success. I mean, Magoo was such an outside success relative to everything else they did. He was considered one of the top box office draws in the mid-1950s. His films were winning Academy Awards. You know, they were trying to make a feature film through the 1950s. And I found this to be a fascinating story because they considered almost everything under the sun, from Gilbert and Sullivan to James Thurber. And ultimately what they wound up doing was the most mediocre thing possible, which is doing just a Magoo feature, which is probably not the savviest move. Because at 7 minutes, Mr. Magoo is pretty charming. At 80 minutes, Mr. Magoo could be a bit hard to take. I mean, go back and think, Walt Disney broke into feature filmmaking, and it would have been very easy for him to make and sell a Mickey Mouse feature, but he knew implicitly that that was not a good idea, that is a character who's built for a 7-minute medium, and at 80 minutes or so, Mickey Mouse could seem a little bit flat. So UPA, because to some extent it's pinioned by Columbia, and because the UPA was such a draw, it was hard to resist, they were kind of compelled to make this film, which wanted to become 1001 Arabian Nights, and was released in 1959, which, if you want to say a year that was the end of UPA as an aesthetic studio, you probably have to pick 1959. Conveniently, 1001 Arabian Nights was released in December, so it makes a nice piece of closure for the decade. So the television stuff came later, and that was when the studio's management changed hands. The owner of UPA in the late 1950s, Steve Bisusto, was pretty much compelled to sell the studio, mainly because he just didn't have the funds to keep it going. So the power shifted to a man named Henry Saperstein, who came from a merchandising point of view and, you know, had done some television production, but he saw UPA as something to exploit and, you know, produced television product. I mean, at the same time, it was not the wrong move. In the 1960s, television was becoming quite strong, and many animators like Hanna-Barbera and even Chuck Jones wound up finding work in television as the classic theatrical short filmmaking studios were going the way of the dinosaur. So it was the right move to make, but strictly speaking, that was not the classic UPA, just because the management shifted, and most of the people who worked at UPA in the 50s were gone by 59 and 60. There were a couple people who came back and did some freelance work, but you really have to say it was a generational shift in there. If you look at the credits for the Mr. Magoo television series of 1960 or the Dick Tracy series that followed, it's pretty much a new staff. So the name UPA remained, the studio remained, the character copyright remained, but to some extent it was a new studio in an old shell.
Well, just when I was feeling bad, like, oh, what a sad story that it ended so soon, you said in the book, and I loved it, you said, well, you know, it's not a sad story that, oh, they only did this. It's such a great story that they were able to do as much as they did in this brief and beautiful period of creativity.
I mean, what they did was against the grain. It shouldn't have happened at all, and I think that's what's most remarkable. I mean, you know, this experience doesn't exist anymore, but when you went to the cinema in the 1940s, you know, you would see a cartoon, a newsreel, a live-action two-reel short. So they were part of this whole system, which essentially was already starting to die by the 1950s when UPA was getting started. So they were against the clock, they were against the grain by doing things that were not Warner Brothers, that were not MGM cartoons, and that were not, for the most part, continuing series characters. So the fact that they were able to do this at all is remarkable. I think we should be pleased. And now they're available on DVD, lo and behold.
And it's odd that they're called limited animation, because the animation might be limited, but the imagination is completely unlimited.
Yeah, the term is an unfortunate one. I mean, I refer to it in the book because it makes sense. I mean, what they were doing was not even limited so much, it was just different. It was different than the Disney model of doing things. It was partly based on an economic reality. You know, the UPA films were cheaper than a Walt Disney film of similar length. But it seems that the numbers were similar to the cost of maybe a Warner Brothers or a Walter Lantz cartoon. So they were not cheap per se, just cheaper than, let's say, MGM and Disney. But they really were just trying to do something different. They were trying to get a different result. I mean, one example is gravity. In a Walt Disney animated cartoon, generally the laws of gravity would prevail. In a UPA cartoon, sometimes a character jumps up in the air and stays there. So it's doing something different. So it's limited, but, you know, only by finances, and certainly not limited by the imagination, I don't think.
Well, Adam Abraham is the author. The book is called When Magoo Flew, The Rise and Fall of Animation Studio UPA, and he is also the author of the notes, I don't know if they call them album notes, what do they call them? Notes, DVD
liner
notes,
liner notes,
yeah, for this wonderful new DVD set from Turner Classic Movies of UPA cartoons. Adam Abraham, thank you so much for spending some time talking about it with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. Find us on Facebook. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. From the Bookshelf, production assistance is provided by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. I also want to thank my guest, Adam Abraham. His book, When Magoo Flew, The Rise and Fall of Animation Studio, UPA. For From the Bookshelf, I am Gary Shapiro. I'll see you next time.